All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm really glad to be with you here today because it was like touch and go for a little while there, right? I did the most insane driving you can imagine to get here, okay? And then as I'm in the middle of it all, I forgot that I left my cell phone at home. So couldn't call people and tell them that I was insanely trying to get here. Anyway, I'm not going to go on. And you're saying, thank you, Michael. All right. It's really a great show today. At the back end of the show, we're going to have the playwright and the cast from a play I saw a couple weeks ago that was just really, really, really remarkably powerful, very good, very moving. It's called Corktown 57, and it's at the Odyssey Theater. And we're going to be talking with, the playwright and the cast, some of the cast members from that play. In the middle of the show, I'm going to be bringing you voices of family, students, and residents of Skid Row from the Los Angeles action on April 14th. Shut it down. The day when people stood up and said, we're not going to allow the blatant, outright genocidal murder of black and brown people to continue. We are going to stop it now. And opening the show up, I'm very, very, very happy to bring back to the show a regular guest and always an interesting guest and always somebody who has something, a lot of important stuff to say. It's Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Carl, welcome back.
Thank you for having me on again, Michael.
Sure, sure. Well, I want to jump into this because I want to squeeze as much as I can out of it, all right? There was a powerful movement to stop police brutality rose out of the streets of Ferguson, Missouri after the police murder of Mike Brown. It drew on the anger built up when a racist vigilante murdered Trayvon Martin and got a pat on the back from the system. And it was fueled by the unbearable reality that every goddamn day police shoot, brutalize, humiliate, terrorize, and murder black and brown people from Staten Island to Los Angeles, from Pasco, Washington to South Carolina, and everywhere in between. That movement last fall rocked this country like nothing since the 60s, but the powers lashed back with beatings and arrests, slanders and lies, with a lot of bull about the dangerous job it is to go out and murder black people and brown people, and with the full backing of this system, you know, building sympathy for the cops. And they made entreaties to have a conversation coupled with threats. December came and stepped up with repression and threats, and the movement got chilled. So a big question had to be answered. And here to talk with us about that is Carl Dix. And as I said, Carl, I want to jump right into it. Let's talk about that, this big question that had to be answered. What was posed in relation to April 14th?
Well, we were really posed at a crossroads. I mean, were the authorities going to get away with suppressing that movement of resistance, that beautiful, powerful, and very necessary movement of resistance that poured into the streets last year, that forced the reality of the way that police brutalize and even murder black people, Latino people, and others onto the front burner of society, something that, you know, the powers that be had to talk about, that Obama had to have meetings at the White House about, and that they had to make false promises, because usually they don't promise to do anything about it, just let it happen, but they were forced to do that. Was that movement going to be suppressed? Was that a brief interlude that would just go back to people suffering this wanton brutality and murder in silence? Or would it come back out in the street? Would it revive that spirit of Ferguson and take it higher? And the first part of that has been answered very affirmatively and clearly with the April 14th National Day of Disrupting Business as Usual, because business as usual in this country includes police getting away with murdering black and Latino people.
Let me ask you this, Carl, because the day, in terms of the day itself, I know what I saw in Los Angeles and what I've read about in other places. This was a remarkable outpouring of people from all over the country, which was an important part of answering that question, as you're saying, right?
Yeah, that was exactly the answer. People took to the streets in more than 30 cities across the country, campuses in many different parts of the country, and we're still getting in the reports on that. But, you know, there was Los Angeles with 1,000 people down at police headquarters. There were more than 1,000 people who gathered in Union Square in New York City who essentially forced their way onto Broadway because the police had determined that if we marched from Union Square, it was going to be on the sidewalk. And the young people especially were not having that. But also, some of the well-known people who were there were not having that. You know, Dr. Cornel West, Reverend Calvin Butts, the Latin jazz, Afro-Latin jazz artist Arturo O'Farrell, the actress and playwright Eve Ensler, the family members of police murder victims, and hundreds of young people. A lot of high school students were there, several hundred of them, and everybody just poured into the streets, took over Broadway, and refused to leave Broadway and marched all the way down to the Brooklyn Bridge and then went over the bridge. And then there was Springfield, Massachusetts, Chicago, Illinois, Cleveland, Ferguson, Atlanta, Pasco, Washington, San Francisco, where City Hall became the site of a rally saying police getting away with murder must stop. And I'm not talking about outside of City Hall. I'm talking about inside City Hall, because the protest went into City Hall with people blowing whistles, chanting, banging drums. And this was the scene all across the country. And again, powerful and beautiful, but also very necessary, because it needed to be stated very clearly to people that, no, we did not go away, and we're not backing down. We are in the streets and staying in the streets until police getting away with murder stops.
You know, it's really, that's extremely important in terms of when you're talking about, I know there's an editorial on revcom.us that just went up after the day of shutting it all down on April 14th. I think it went up last night or yesterday evening. At any rate, the point that it talks about is basically, yes, Iran is going back on the offensive. And it says that this marked a new beginning for the struggle against this outrage. So we have this thing of, in a lot of ways, how this actually marked a new beginning. And one thing I think, you know, what you're speaking to is in terms of the breadth of the people that were there. But also there's other questions tied up with this really needing to, and did it actually take the leap that it needed to take?
Yeah, well, see, I think it really did. And this was something, look, this was a fight all the way down to the end. I mean, this was not in the media the way that we had hoped it would be leading into it and that we were working to make it. When I left to go to Union Square on Tuesday, people were saying, well, what are we going to have? And I'm saying, well, whatever we have, this is what we're starting with. And we're going to go from here. But we had people back in the streets, you know, and we have to build on this. If we rest here, we will not have really answered the question, yes, we're back, but we are going to go from here. And that was a real determination that was displayed yesterday at a press conference we held at City Hall to denounce the police attack on the demonstration here in New York. And that was an important feature of the April 14th shutdown day, and that is that in some cities the police came back at it very viciously. Here in New York, there were 42 people arrested. Several protesters were brutalized so bad they had to go to the hospital that day. I know in Los Angeles, you all had, like, what, 15 arrests at the main rally and some arrests out at the UCLA. Springfield, Massachusetts, there were a number of people arrested. But here in New York, they not only arrested a lot of people, they broke one sister's ribs. Another guy went to the hospital thinking he had a broken leg. One guy, they had to get him emergency medical care because he was unconscious in the paddy wagon, although they left him there unconscious for a while. And the other people that they had arrested had to just, you know, say, hey, you got to get this guy some medical attention, and had to raise, you know, holy hell to get that to happen. There was that. Also, during the protests, an undercover cop pulled his gun out on protesters on the Brooklyn Bridge and pointed it right at a 15-year-old high school student. This is how they responded to it. And there was a real clear message in that, and that is that we will arrest you, we will brutalize you, we will intimidate you, so get back out of the street and stop this. And to make the message real clear, the mayor came out with a statement that night saying that the protesters had threatened violence against the police and that the protests would be subjected to thorough investigation And if anyone was found out to have done that, the mayor would recommend that they be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. Now, this is the mayor of New York City, the guy who presided over the police murder of Eric Garner, the one that was caught on video and seen around the world, and that the grand jury decided that those murderers in blue, had committed no crime, promising a thorough investigation and prosecution to the full extent of the law of people who were protesting that kind of murder and brutality and who were subjected to that kind of murder and brutality during that protest. These remarks and the attack by the NYPD is unacceptable, and we're not going to back down in the face of them. We've mounted a campaign, and we announced it at that press conference yesterday, to have all the charges dropped against everybody arrested in the protest. And we demanded that the mayor repudiate and retract his remarks. And at the press conference, we had the picture of the cop pulling his gun on the protesters, the pictures of cops breaking the sister's ribs during the protest, and said, here's the violence that happened yesterday. You want to investigate something, investigate the NYPD for what it was doing to people in the street, not the people who were protesting this kind of wanton brutality and even murder from this police department.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix. Carl's from the Revolutionary Communist Party and a co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, along with Cornel West. Now, Carl, the things that you're talking about right now, it's extremely important, and I don't think you can emphasize it enough, and I certainly don't think I can emphasize it enough, that this is an extremely important to go on the political and legal offensive against any and all of this brutality perpetrated by the police and anything that they're doing to come down on people. It's extremely important, because, you know, that's actually one of the ways that they will try to crush and demoralize people even coming off of this thing. But there's a point where, and I know you've talked about this a little too in the days that have followed, that even with that, as important as it is, it's also important to stay on the offensive right now. And I wanted to talk about that, and also this thing of one of the major elements that you've alluded to, but the idea, the role of youth in this. I mean, I was really just overjoyed when I came down to the police headquarters and I saw all these people, all these young people that were out there. I mean, high school students who had walked out of school, and the spirit they brought to it, the cacophony of whistleblowing all the time and the cheering whenever anything went up and the listening very seriously. And this whole thing of moral certitude and enthusiasm, and you're not going to do anything to stop us, it was brought by these young people to this. This actually bodes pretty well in terms of, this is something we really have to pay attention to in terms of actually going on the offensive, strengthening this, keeping it going, right?
Yes, exactly. And let me go back to the press conference briefly, because at the press conference we had a number of the young people who had been arrested in the protest, and they were all very proud of what they had done. One young man, young brother who's a Columbia student, said, this was the first time I've ever been arrested in my life, and it was the proudest moment of his life. And then he said, I want to say to the NYPD, if you think you were stopping me from continuing to protest by arresting me, you are wrong. The exact opposite. I'm even now even more determined to be in the streets and stay in the streets. And this was a sentiment that was shared by a whole lot of the people there, and the young people at this press conference who were declaring their determination to fight to stop this. And this is very necessary because, look, any movement for change is got to be a movement of the youth to really have the staying power to deal with the kind of problems that we're up against. Because when we talk about police murder, we're not talking about a few bad apples. We're not talking about isolated incidents. We're talking about something that's built into the fabric and framework of this capitalist imperialist system. It ain't going to be a thing that's settled by getting a Democrat into office or anything like that. We actually have to take on this system and build a movement that is ready to fight this system over this horror that it's bringing down. And ultimately, look, it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to end it once and for all. And that's why we in the Revolutionary Communist Party take the approach of fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution, because that's what's going to be needed. And a revolutionary movement does have to be a movement of youth. We got some veterans with a lot of experience, like Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party. I've got a bit of experience myself. We've got other veterans. But we have to bring forward a new generation of revolutionaries. And I saw the potential for that in the spirit that people had, in the work that people did to mobilize breakouts from high school, because most of the high schools that people broke out of, there were a few where there were administrative people and stuff like that who were with folks, but most of the high schools that people came out of, they had to do it over the opposition of administrators, teachers, security guards, that kind of stuff, and they did it.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me talk a little bit more, because we only have maybe six more minutes left, something like that. I want to talk about this, you know, in terms of where to now. It does seem like this is a big question, because on the one hand, you have this surge that really exists and is there and is real and has really struck a blow and brought things back out in onto the streets in a way that they needed to. At the same time, as we're saying, it does have to go forward around this, and it does have to, and that means that there's actually, you know, we can't just sit and think that, okay, it's got to go forward, and then it's going to sort of, everything's going to just roll along. There was a lot brought out, but there really has to need be some kind of program that's actually going to be bringing people together to accomplish both the fight against the genocidal assault on Black and brown people, as well as, you know, the what you're talking about in terms of other people who are also building for a revolutionary change in society. Let's talk about what needs to be done now.
Well, what needs to be done is that we have to build off of what was accomplished on the 14th. We can't rest on our laurels, think like, okay, we've done it, let's see what they do, will they change? No, they're not going to change unless they're made to change, and it's going to take a movement of hundreds of thousands and millions of people to fight to beat them back on this front. And it's got to be increasingly connected up with struggles on other fronts against other outrages that must be stopped, that this system is perpetrating. In terms of particularly on this front, we have to put together a full nationwide program, but we are in the streets and staying in the streets. I mean, like the high school students' response to a number of them being arrested on April 14th, was to call for being in the streets next Thursday here in New York City. So the Stop Mass Incarceration Network is going to be there with them. Mothers and some fathers of police murder victims have called for descending on Washington, D.C. on Mother's Day weekend. Stop Mass Incarceration Network has endorsed that call, and we're going to be working to make that happen. And as we do that, we're going to develop an overall program to take on nationwide in an increasingly on the offensive way the whole slow genocide targeting Black and Latino people. And the concentration of that right now is taking on and fighting to stop these murders that are coming down on a daily basis. And it's not only that they happen on a daily basis, but they're put right out in your face on a daily basis. You know, videos of cops shooting people in the back and planting evidence on them. Videos of part-time, pay-to-play cops being given a trip on the safari to tase and murder the animals, which is what they consider Black and Latino people. That's what happened in Tulsa with this part-time cop who paid a lot of money to the sheriff there for his political campaigns, and in return got to ride around and use his taser and gun on people and got caught on video murdering somebody. This is what's going on. It's going on regularly. You can't, well, Bill O'Reilly claims it's isolated incidents, but we know Bill O'Reilly's a big liar anyway. You can no longer reasonably claim that this doesn't happen widespread. And it needs to be dealt with, and we have to develop a program to do that. As we do that, we're going to pull the lens back and show people that these murders are a concentration of a slow genocide that rests on the criminalization and dehumanization of whole generations of Black and Latino people, to bring forward a more overall program of fighting that slow genocide and fighting to stop it.
Mm-hmm. All right, Carl, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I want you real quick, tell people where they can go to find out more. How can they get hooked up? What's the number? What's the email address? And what's the website?
Okay. Where you need to go is to the website of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, which is stopmassincarceration.net. That's stopmassincarceration, all one word, .net. You also need to go to the website of Revolution Newspaper, and that's revcom.us. That's revcom.us. And if you want to contact the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and you want to do it old school, here's a national phone number for you to call. The area code is 646-709-1961. You call that number and you can get hooked up and you can get started. You can find out how to get materials if you're in an area where there's no organization at this point and how to get started. If you're in an area where there is organization, the people that answer the phone there will connect you up with somebody who's already working on this and some people that you can work with.
All right, Carl, we're going to have to wrap it up right now. So thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
All right, take care. Talk to you again soon. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Carl Dix from the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and the Revolutionary Communist Party. And we've been talking about April 14th, Shut It Down, the day when the movement against the slow genocide against by police against black and brown people was taken on, pushed back, and people came out in the streets and brought things to a whole new day. And we had how that's got to get continued. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with voices from the families, students, and residents of Skid Row who were in the Los Angeles action on April 14th.
On the police murder of Jonathan Rodney. Death dirges. Death dirges make no lilting sounds, only heavy trudging as of prisoners' lonely shuffling feet. Death dirges make no syncopating saxophonic sounds, just mournful tones like tolling bells. Hell, the stinking stench of wanton murder, sickly smells that tell of...
I'd love to play the rest of that song, but we just don't have the time right now. It's on The Police Murder of Jonathan Rodney, and it's by Fred Ho and Raul Arcelinas, right? So you can check that out. Really, really powerful song. All right, I'm going to jump right into this, but I just want you to know these are voices from the rally in Los Angeles on April 14th. And it's basically family members, students, and residents of Skid Row, and high school students we're talking about here, and residents of Skid Row who were speaking on that day. So check this out.
Today we are saying no more to this genocide, no more to the police killing black and brown people who are unarmed and with no justifiable cause. Give it up for the families that are here, the families who are brave enough to tell their stories. After all the bullshit that gets told that it was your fault, these families are bringing to life the reality of what the police do day in and day out. I want to introduce the last family that will be speaking today. I want to introduce Oscar Ramirez and Oscar Ramirez Sr., the son. He was shot in the back and murdered by Paramount on October 22nd, 2014. Let's hear it for this family.
Don't shoot, officer. It's only a mic. Got my hands up, right? I'm just going to speak. All right, just like 5 minutes of your time, right? I only need 5 minutes of your time. All right. My brother, Oscar Ramirez, was killed October 27th around like 2:30 in the afternoon at Paramount. Right outside while the girls' soccer team was practicing. So they witnessed everything. Those poor innocent little girls, they're like 9 years old, or like 11, I forget. Wow, it feels so good to see all your faces, all the youth. All the youth that I know is gonna improve the future for everybody. Black and brown and everywhere in the middle. Ooh. I have this chant that I remember when people came to help us out when we were chanting Paramount. It goes, Oscar Ramirez, rest in peace. Never forget, f*** the police. So what I want, I'm gonna do Oscar Ramirez, you guys say rest in peace, I say never forget, and in unison, I want everybody here to turn around. And look at them right there. Everybody run out, turn around. Look at the police, turn around. All right, you guys ready? All right, Oscar Ramirez. Never forget. Oscar Ramirez. Never forget. Oscar Ramirez. Never forget. Oh God, that feels so good. You know why? This right here is what matters. You know what doesn't matter? All that bullshit, keeping up with the Kardashians, Facebook, Twitter, going on likes. That's all bullshit. This is what fucking matters. Take it back with your fucking strength.
Teacher told me, surrender. And I told him, I won't till I get justice. And he said, I can't believe you walked out. He said, you are too smart to make a change. I'm too smart to make a change. And you want to know what I said? I told them, I'm not too smart to make a change. Look how many people I got to walk out today. Look at how many people stand by my word. Look at how many people say, I know what's up. I'm gonna study law one day and make justice for everybody in here. I'm not like these corrupted cops out here. I want justice. And I wanna shout out the SAP group who is also here supporting. We had a lot of people help organize this today. Junior class president, we have our school president here today. Shout out to everybody for being an upstander, honestly. And stop police brutality. That's what we're all about.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and you're listening right now to some of the voices that were down in front of the LA police headquarters on April 14th. The A14 shut it down actions that happened all across the country. People standing up and saying, we're bringing to a stop this racist police murder of black and brown people. And the voices include the family of Oscar Ramirez Jr., a high school student who helped the leader walk out in her school and join hundreds of other students down at the rally, and some people from Skid Row.
She told me when she came up here, the part she didn't add was that these students have been threatened with all these repercussions for walking out. They said they're going to take their prom away. They're going to do all these to take all this stuff away from them for what they've done for walking out. But what they've done in walking out means something to the whole world. It means something to all of us here. And everybody here is here because we know. We are putting ourselves on the line for something that means something to all of humanity. We are going to do that all day long, and we responsibility of everybody with a conscience. And we are going to put everything out there. Everything, our bodies on the line, ourselves on the line. For what? For changing the future.
They may have taken our softball and baseball season away, but that's okay because we're here for the future. For what matters then. We are the youth. And if we are the future, then why can't we make our own future and stand up for what we believe in? Because this will last forever. I give props to those of you who came out here today and your parents threatened you. Your parents told you you cannot go out there. Your parents told you to stay away. Well, you know what? The whooping is going to hurt today. But this will hurt forever if we let it be.
Excuse me, I can't breathe. For you students from Fremont High School, God bless you. I'm a graduate of Fremont High School, 1971, Como Fantante, right on. Okay, and I'm not gonna say the police because they don't make bulletproof condoms. But they do have our back because that's what they aim for. I'm down here helping to represent the people from Skid Row, the voice that's never heard. This young lady standing next to me has been on Skid Row in a tent for a year and doesn't have to be. She does free alterations for the homeless or anybody else on Skid Row, all right? And doesn't have to be. Now, before I let her speak, I want to do this. If you got Twitter and all that crap, Samuel L. Jackson made a challenge. Samuel L. Jackson made a challenge to all them ice buckets, them celebrities. He did a song, real quick, real short. I can hear my neighbor crying, I can't breathe. Now I'm in the struggle and I can't leave. Calling out the violence of the racial police. We ain't gonna stop till our people are free. We ain't gonna stop till our people are free. One more time. I can hear my neighbor crying. I can't breathe. Now I'm in the struggle and I can't leave. Calling out the violence of the racist police. We ain't gonna stop until our people are free. We ain't gonna stop until our people are free. Now, I'm going to come back in a minute, but first of all, y'all, please give it up to this lady who's down there doing it in the bottoms. Give it up for Miss Stephanie.
Good afternoon, Skid Row! How we feeling today? Ask me why do I sleep in a tent. Because the police broke my motherfucking leg. I'm blessed to be standing here today. I was in a wheelchair for a year and a half. Some of you guys may have known. I came every day in that wheelchair and still sold people's clothes up for free. I'm blessed to be walking today. I'm gonna tell my story. My son was locked up for sleeping with a minor. He's still in jail today. They wanted to give him 300 years. They sentenced him for 28 years. My son asked me to come to Indianapolis, Indiana, to help him get on his feet. He just turned 21 and he had a 5-year-old daughter with him, taking care of her because the mother couldn't. I took my ass all the way to Indianapolis to get my leg broke, but I'm not going to go in there, but I went there to help my son get on his feet, right? 2 months later, they kicked in the door. They said my son was sleeping with a minor. I stayed in that apartment waiting on my son's return, paying his rent every month for 6 months. 2 months after we got the apartment, the police noticed the door that they had kicked the hell out of, and they said, this is the same door we kicked the hell out of. And you the mother of the pedophile. And we should break your motherfucking legs. And you're trespassing. I reached to show them the 6 months rent receipts that I had. They said I was going for a gun. I held my hands up and I said, don't shoot. They beat me down like Rodney King. They beat me in my head. They hit me in my chest. They hit me in my stomach and threw me down. It took my leg and twisted it till it snapped. Then they took the handcuffs and tried to squeeze the hell out of my arm. It was three police officers, one female and two males. The woman police officer said, I will bash your motherfucking face in. I looked at her, I said, you hit me, I'm gonna hit you back. I got on the next plane to come home to LA, where I've been for 20 years. I have a warrant for my arrest. Police officers, I say, come and get me. I got unfinished business. All I can say right now is, I'm fed up. I'm tired. I've had enough. I'm taking a stand today for all you cowards that can't stand here today. I was a coward. Don't be ashamed. I didn't want to come here today. I don't know where this voice came, but it came. I'm going to stand on Skid Row. I'm going to remain in my tent. That's where they wanted me at. That's where I'm going to stay. Until they put me in a place where I need to be, I'm going to take a stand for everybody. I'm fed up. I ain't going to take it no more. I'm fed up. I ain't taking no more. I'm fed up. Can't take it no more. I'm fed up. I'm fed up. I can't take it no more. I'm fed up. Can't take it no more. I'm fed up. I can't hear you. Floating whistle. Thank you for sharing.
A lot of people or a lot of police always say on the news, and especially those Rush Limbaugh folks, and oh, it's not racist. It's not racial. Then why is it always happening to us? We got a Amber Alert. We got Megan's Law. We still trying to find out who killed Natalie Holloway. But what about little Ebony? What about Nigel? What about them? We don't count? Okay? Look around. Look what we got next to each other. Do me a favor, y'all. You know what we need? What we need is change. What we need is change. What we need is change. I was born by a river in a little tent. Oh, like a river I've been running ever since. It's been a long, long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long, long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Now I go to the movies and I go downtown. People keep telling me, no, don't hang around. It's been a long, long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Then I go to my brother and I say, brother, help me please. But sometimes all them crazy LAPD folk keep knocking me down on my knees. Oh, there times that I thought I couldn't last for long. But now I believe I'm able to carry on. It's been a long, long time coming, but I know LAPD, a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will. God bless you, y'all. Let's not take this shit no more.
All right, welcome back. That was voices from the April 14th Shut It Down Day against police brutality and murder. And we're going to be taking a quick musical break and be right back with the playwright and a couple of the cast members from the play Corktown 57. So don't run away. This is going to be great, all right? Welcome back. This is the Michael Slate Show, and that was Saul Williams, all right? Sunday Bloody Sunday, and it was a collaboration he did with Trent Reznor from Nine Inch Nails, all right? And it was off the album The Inevitable Rise and Liberation of Niggy Tardust, and it's just a great song, a great album, so you should check that out. All right, I saw a play. Actually, I saw it a couple weeks ago. The person I went with said, wow, and I was sitting there, I said, yeah, really? Really, really liked it. And the play is Corktown 57. And I'm not going to tell you what it's about because I'm going to ask the playwright to tell you. But joining us right now is John Fazakerly.
That's right.
Okay, we got that one, yes. And John Ruby and Rebecca Tilney. John Fazakerly is, I'm going to be saying that name like that all the way through, man.
Fazakerly.
John Fazakerly.
Fazakerly.
Fazakerly. Okay, Fazakerly. Okay, you got me. Now I feel so bummed out, man. Anyway. John is the playwright, and the two actors from the play are John Ruby and Rebecca Tilney. All right, so John Fazakerly.
Yes, Michael.
Tell us where this play, Corktown 57, where did it come, what's it about, and where did it come from?
Well, it came from my memory bank and also my imagination. I mean, I guess I should tell the story of how it initially began with me. When my dad passed away, I received a shoebox full of photographs. And in the box, there was a photograph of my grandfather holding me in the church steps the day of my baptism, and I'm a swaddled baby. Well, that photograph is now the poster for the show. But it inspired me to write a play, and in this case, you know, about my grandfather. And I began to think in terms of my grandfather as he was very supportive of the Irish Republican movement, so that's the memory part. The imagination part was I did the big what if, and what if he was a major player in that movement in Philadelphia. And a lot of people don't realize it, but Philadelphia raised a lot of money. The Irish community in Philadelphia raised a lot of money for the original Easter Rising back about 1914 or so, which predated the actual when the war broke out. But a lot of money was raised in Corktown by a fellow named Joe McGarity. And in my imaginings, I made my grandfather his right-hand man, so to speak. So anyway, he's older in life, and he's seeking a way to become relevant again in the eyes of the movement. So that's kind of where the play started for me.
All right, and let me, Rebecca, I'm going to go to you.
Okay.
Because your character actually comes right off of that, and then John, we'll get to you because your character actually comes off of that even further. So,
right.
Rebecca, your character, tell people your character, who she is, and what she's about.
Well, my character is Caitlin, and she's the oldest daughter of the patriarch of the family. She came over from Ireland with the family when she was probably in her early 20s, so she was raised in Ireland. And because she's older than, you know, she's basically the oldest girl. There's one sibling older than she is. She's very, very involved in the cause. And she's also sort of, I like to think of, she is her father's daughter, for sure. And she is, you know, carrying that torch of what, you know, she's been raised to believe that, you know, for the Irish movement. So she basically comes and she becomes basically a drug runner. I mean, she is raising money via cookie drives, you know, in the guise of being a very socially conventional Catholic woman on the outside, but really being quite a passionate, militant, you know, woman of the cause who's raising money for guns and sending them, you know, back to Ireland. And she's given up her sort of personal life. I like to think, I mean, it's implied in the play that she's had, you know, various affairs, but given those up because she is so involved and so staunchly faithful to what she believes is the way.
Mm-hmm. John, your character is someone who's sort of like, there's a gap between everybody else in the family that's portrayed as your family in the play and you. Let's talk about your character.
Sure. My character is Frank Keating. And I think the play deals a lot with family versus politics. And that's what's a very interesting thing is, you know, what do people put first and where are their priorities? And, you know, not that it has to be an either or, but how that kind of struggle between those two things play out. So my character, Frank, invites his brother over, who's joined the British Army. And when he comes to Corktown in Philadelphia, it kind of like lights a match on this fuse because the rest of the family is very pro-Irish. And his coming to Corktown just starts this explosion of things. And that's where the family dynamic really comes into play with my father not wanting to see him, but also wanting to see him and tell him his feelings. My sister, Kate, coming and doing pretty much the same thing, and just how that all plays out. Because Frank, my character, has his own problems going on with his wife and with a son who's acting out and getting in fights and things like that.
Let me go back to you, John Fazakerly. Okay. Just so we can clarify it's over here. The play, you know, I mean, I know it's really, you know, on some level you can't say, yes, it's family versus politics. But it seemed to me, and I guess it's actually in a sense, there's a lot of ideological thinking and struggle going on in this thing.
Yeah.
You know, because none of the characters are flat. They're not one-dimensional.
Yeah.
And they've got their weaknesses, they've done bad things, they've done good things, but there's a certain thing that people have pursued in their life as this is what's important. It doesn't come down to so much to, you know, saying, like you said, John, either or, but it's actually, you know, it actually does come down to a thing of people, ideologically, people are struggling with, what do you do in a world that's so screwed up?
Right. You ask me what?
Yes. No, I'm asking about the
well,
play.
There are no shrinking violets in this family for sure. And everybody has a strong point of view about mm-hmm. things. The only one, talking about John's character, the only one that was actually born in America is John's character and his wife, actually, and his son, of course. But everybody else was born on the other side. And ideologically, I mean, you know, like any sectarian situation, you know, there's strong feelings, you know, both ways. And in this particular case, those strong feelings are ignited when this character of this, what they think of as this traitorous son comes back. John's character has this need to see his brother, to meet his brother. See, he's never met his brother. His brother was born in Ireland and ended up, when the family emigrated to America, he went to England. And that's what caused the schism in the family, as far as he's concerned. You know, so he's the traitorous son and the prodigal traitorous son.
Well, we can, without giving anything away, really, we can also say that he went to England and he became a bit of an ass.
Well, he did. I mean,
a traitorous ass.
Well,
okay.
Depends on what side of the argument you're on, I suppose.
But he
joined the British Army. But even previous to that, he was conscripted into World War I, the character I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And then after that war, he got out and it was hard to find work. And he ended up, there was a family obligation that he took on, that he shouldered the debt to pay for the family's passing to America. So in a way, they should have gratitude towards what he did for them. But on the other hand, they hate him for all these other things that he's done. So he ends up joining the an organization called the Black and Tans, which was, you know, if people know the history of it, the Black and Tans were a paramilitary organization that wreaked havoc with the civilian population in Ireland. To this day, they're reviled. Mm-hmm. So he, you know, that's the sin that he has going for him. And then after that, he then continued in the military and has risen to the rank of brigadier general in the British military.
And he's in MI5, too.
And he is.
So it's kind of a, I mean, it's really, and it is, it's a little bit like, you know, one of Woody Allen's characters, the Jewish guy that suddenly took a job with the Gestapo. It's like...
Which Woody Allen movie?
In my head, it would be a Woody Allen movie.
The one he didn't
sounds
write.
Like something.
Maybe he wasn't right. Right.
The one in his body.
Right. It's the Zelig. It's the part in Zelig that got cut out.
Okay.
There you go. Anyway, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking about the play Corktown 57. Now, this play is situated in the Corktown section of Philadelphia. It's one of the Irish ghettos of that existed in Philadelphia in 1957. And the play is all about the struggle within a family that takes place over how to look at and how to be part of or not be part of, or what stand do you take in relation to the struggle of the Irish people against British imperialism. And it's got quite a few interesting twists. It's a powerful depiction of some of the very critical questions that we have to come up against and answer for ourselves often these days, particularly in terms of standing up for what's right and against what's wrong. And for that reason alone, I think it's well worth talking about it with the playwright John Fazakerly and actors John Ruby and Rebecca Tilney.
Rebecca, your character is, you know, I mean, I have to tell you, I just found it so refreshing, because there is a question of moral certitude that's involved in the play, which I think is really important, and it comes from both sides. Even to a certain extent, I'll talk with you, John, about it late in a minute. But there's a moral certitude that your character brought to it that was so damn refreshing, and she wasn't going to her life when her brother's telling her, look, this could, you know, you could be in big trouble here, and she's saying, screw you. Yeah. I'm doing this, you know, yeah. and stuck with it.
Yeah.
And I thought that was extremely important. You know, it's just, it was so, again, in a time when people are looking for what's right and what's wrong. And I'm not saying there's no nuance and there's no, you know, complexity, but so often we raise complexity and nuance as a reason for sort of not doing things.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought your character was just written in a way that was sort of, there's a moral certitude that was really important.
Well, I love that. I mean, I love that about her. I mean, when I read the play originally, when I read something and it really, I respond to it, my heart just starts thumping. And that's what happened when I read that play. It doesn't happen very often or often enough as far as I'm concerned. And I just, that's what I loved about her, was that she was so strong-willed and so clear about what she believed in. And I think that's what's so interesting too, especially because I don't know how you feel, but I feel like today, there's not enough people stepping up to the plate and really following through on what they believe in, as you said, moral certitude. So I really love that about her. And I think that what's interesting in all the characters and the whole situation of the play is, as you said, again, the complexity of everything and the different levels. I mean, we're talking about betrayal and loyalty and faith and love and all those things where It's not black and white. I mean, here's this, you know, character that comes into the play. Her brother, who she hasn't seen in 40 years, who, you know, she has to have some kind of residual feelings for, but she cannot let go of the fact that she feels that he betrayed the family.
Mm-hmm. John, we're going to have to, because I'm watching the clock and damn, time goes fast. But John, I want to ask you about your character too, because your character is a likable guy, and actually, you know, the basement looked a lot like.
Yeah, there's a great set design. Yeah, great set design. Yeah, it feels like you're in a real Philly basement.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And including with all the stuff with the way the washer and refrigerator and the bar, the table.
The bar is
anyway,
used a lot.
The bar is used. Right.
There's a lot of drinking in this family. Right, a lot of whiskey.
Right. But we know that was just to hide the tears, okay, or to bring them on. Anyway,
yeah.
But let's talk about your character for a minute, just and literally we have about a minute and a half, 2 minutes,
sure.
But just, you know, because your character is a very complex character. It's as John was saying, it's you're the one character who wasn't born in Ireland, you know, but you're there and you're trying to make things, you're trying to mend fences to a certain extent, as mm-hmm. well as to have your own sense of family and something bigger. But there's something that there's also something else that's edgy, and we won't say what happens, but it's there's actually something else that actually you go through a transformation mm-hmm. by the time the play is over, which I thought was really, really, really yeah. interesting, very heavy.
Yeah,
yeah. I think it's Frank goes on a journey of becoming a man, and that's really what he. You know, in his family, he's always been the youngest brother. He's kind of been the baby. And through this process of dealing with his dad, dealing with his brothers and his sisters, he grows into a man. And it's really interesting because Frank needs his family. And I think a lot of the play is about people needing each other on a certain level. But then on another level, it's about, you know, standing up and doing, you know, what you believe. And so that kind of dichotomy of those two things is what Frank is trying to figure out and is having struggling to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it actually, in a certain sense, it actually helps to be an engine that's pushing things along in a certain sense with the whole play, which is really,
yeah.
I really liked.
Yeah.
That moral certitude and that point that you were making about it's for people to stand up and put their money mm-hmm. where their mouth is. Take a stand.
Well, take a stand.
Take a stand. And yeah. There's way too little of that. And, you know, one of the fundamental questions involved in this whole play that's there all the time is the right of the people of Ireland to be free.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something and I thought of Bobby Sands and the parallels with the people and the 200 people that are in prison during the time of the play.
Yeah.
There's a right that's been fundamentally crushed and denied and militarily enforced for generations, and that is that's something we need moral certitude mm-hmm. around. John, we're gonna have to wrap this up, but I want to thank you very much for the play, man.
Thank you, Michael.
Sure, sure. It's been
I
really
appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely. And listen, folks, the play is Corktown 57. So I want to thank you all for joining us today, and thanks for
thank
the play.
You.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you for having us, Michael.
All right,
thank
you're
you
listening.
So much.
Sure, you're welcome. You're listening to the Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with John Fazakerly, the playwright of the play Corktown 57, and two of the actors from the play, John Ruby and Rebecca Tilney. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board offer today, Federico Garcia, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And now I was thinking about picking out a song that would go along with the whole focus of today's show. And it hit me. I haven't played this for a long time. And really, I should probably play it a lot more. All right, so we're going to go out now with Uprising from Muse. Check this out.
Paranoia is in bloom. The PDR transmissions will resume. I'll try to push drugs to keep us all down. See the truth around. Another promise, another sin.